Today, the Bond King rules. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Steve Van Meter. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Martin.
Great to have you back on the show. And boy, you've been busy with your visual aids, but Mr. Bond King, what's going on?
Well, if we're going to be the Bond King, we might as well wear the crown, right?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, yeah. No, it's very, very appropriate given where we are. And look, let's start with Jerome Powell's speech a couple of weeks ago, right? It was a sort of a virtual, central bankers meeting. But Powell signaled effectively inflation is going to be allowed to rip a bit more than previously. In other words, they're not going to start lifting rates. And of course, bond rates then reacted as you'd expect, which means that interest rates lower for longer, which means that bond yields go, woo.
Yeah, I don't think, Martin, the people really understood what Powell was saying. They heard what they wanted to hear. And in the past, when all the Federal Reserve would do is when they hit their target. So when the year-over-year rate of the Consumer Price Index or the PCE would get to that 2% level, they would start to taper QE or perhaps raise the federal funds rate. They would just back off the monetary gas, so to speak. And they figured out that, well, that really doesn't work. And so now they've come up with average inflation targeting. So now we're going to use multiple metrics, which we're not really sure what those are, but I suppose we'll find out on Wednesday. And even if we don't know exactly what they are, all Powell is saying is instead of the first target hitting 2%, we're going to let it go a little bit over. So now it's going to look like this, and then we're going to taper. And everyone took that to mean, oh, they've got a way to create inflation. Inflation's going to go over 2%. And we saw that immediate reaction that yields went boop. And then, of course, like a week later, you start to see yields coming back down as the reality of the market figures out that the Fed can talk all they want, but they don't have the tools or mechanisms to create or get inflation up to that level.
Yeah. And that really is the point, isn't it? Because, I can't remember ever seeing so much consensus, which I think is wrong, which is that there's massive inflation around the corner. People keep referring back to the 70s and, we're going to get back into the 70s with massively high. We're in a whole new world. I just can't see how that's going to work.
Yeah, I agree. I keep hearing that we're back in the 70s, but there's a big difference between now and the 70s. In the 70s, we went off the gold standard and onto the dollar standard. And this is a really hard area for people to understand. And the way I try to explain it is all of a sudden, the dollars in the system started to expand because prior to that, gold acted as a limiter. So you can only have so much currency. And in a fractional reserve system that had a large number of banks, all of a sudden money just started multiplying really quickly. And interest rates have to rise during that period of time. And I try to explain it to people. It's like, think of it like a sponge. So you spill water on the floor and what do? You're going to get out your mop or your sponge and you're going to try to soak it up. That's what interest rates do. So they rise to try to slow down and absorb that currency expansion. And that's where we get the whole notion that, okay, this is going to happen again because quantitative easing is really inflationary. Yet there's absolutely no evidence and no data to support that, everyone's afraid that we're going to see that replay. And you're right. The system is completely different. We're on the dollar standard now. We're not coming off of something. We're still there.
Absolutely. And of course, if you look around the world, look into Europe with the Eurozone or Japan, who've actually been at this for longer, all the evidence basically suggests that they are having huge issues trying to get any inflation to work at all.
Right. And so perfect example, like you said, Japan or Europe, more quantitative easing has not led to more inflation. In fact, it's done just the opposite. It's caused interest rates to be suppressed downward. And it's led to disinflation or outright deflation in some cases. But for whatever reason, U.S. investors are just so different. They think, and it's weird to me, because most Americans don't know what hyperinflation is, and they think what we saw in the 70s was really high inflation. But, you know, looking around the world, it's not high as we've seen in other places, but yet Americans are so fearful that inflation's coming. And yet the monetary system by design and quantitative easing by design aren't inflationary. I mean, if you look at the history of central banks, and I know you have, and I know we've talked about it on your show, is they were designed to quell inflation. They weren't given the tools. And I use the example of, if my house is on fire, I'm going to call the fire department, because they're a purpose-built entity to put out fires. Every tool they have is to put out fires. Now, if I want to light my house on fire, I don't call the fire department, because it's not like they have the tools to do that. And the problem is, everyone thinks the Fed has these tools to create inflation. They just haven't figured out what they are. Well, it's been, you know, 100 years? They still can't figure it out? But yet everyone believes and is afraid that it's just right around the corner. But the reality is, it's not.
And, you know, the interesting observation is they've been certainly over the last decade pulling those same levers, right? And pulling them harder and harder and harder. And you know, essentially not getting the result they want. So what do? They pull them a bit harder and try again. But it's you know, the old definition of insanity, isn't it? You do the same thing and expect a different outcome.
Right. You know, if I'm trying to knock a wall down and I go and push on it and it doesn't, you know, fall over. So then I go get a sledgehammer. If that doesn't do it, well, then I go smash into it with my truck. If that doesn't do it, well, then I just need a bulldozer. If that doesn't do it, I just need something bigger, because eventually I'm going to break through it. While that works, so I will get that wall knocked down with monetary policy, bigger is not actually better. The more the Fed does, the more disinflationary and deflationary pulses they actually cause. They just don't realize it.
Yeah. And, you know, I was talking to Harry Dent the other day, and he makes the point that you don't think of this just as a linear relationship. You have to actually do logarithmically more to try and actually get any impact. So basically, the chances of them being able to do enough to have anything other than more deflation is actually almost impossible.
Correct. And I use the phrase on my show all the time that quantitative easing is deflationary until it becomes inflationary. And everyone's reaction is, well, wait a minute, time out. I thought, Steve, it was inflationary. I said, well, it's not, because what the Fed has to do is they have to lower interest rates. And that's the key thing. Quantitative easing causes interest rates to go down. Now, we learned from Milton Friedman that periods of low or falling interest rates signal tight monetary policy. So what do I mean by it tightens financial conditions until it eases? Trigger that eases. Well, Harry Dent knows you have to have interest rates low enough to spur people to borrow money, and that money is created. And of course, everyone thinks that the zero bound is massively inflationary, and I'm actually not 100% sure it is. But wherever that level is, and I don't know if we'll get there, but there is a point where we can get interest rates low enough to spur people to borrow to cause a creation of money. Maybe we're past that point. I don't know. But I think Harry's spot on.
And of course, the other angle here is that you can actually make money available to borrow, but you still need people who are willing and able to borrow it, right? Which is fundamentally different. And with high unemployment and with a number of businesses really struggling, the banks may not be that willing to lend, and consumers and businesses may not be able to borrow. So you can create this pool of money, but it doesn't necessarily have any impact.
And you nailed it perfectly. So that is what the Fed's trying to do. They're trying to get the banks to lend by doing quantitative easing. They're trying to suppress interest rates to bring people to borrow in it. And we do know in a debt-based economy, there's always a shortage of dollars or of currency. So people do need to borrow. There's no question about it. But now we go look at lending standards. And this is really one of the big key determinants that we're going to see deflation, because back in late 2008, lending standards at banks spiked. I mean, they got so tight, they said, we're not gonna lend to anybody. Well, right now, as of the end of last quarter, lending standards are almost as tight as they were as 2008 across the board. And we're not at that point where we were in the fourth quarter of 2008, where the world was literally just crumbling down. And it only makes me wonder is, well, things are gonna get tighter, and the banks just don't want to lend. And I don't blame them, because you look at who out there wants to borrow. Well, those people, like you said, maybe not have, maybe don't have jobs or their businesses are struggling. The people the banks want to borrow, the rich, they don't really need to right now.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, and it's the other thing, of course, to remember is that the global financial crisis hit in 2008, but the real economic outfall in terms of employment or unemployment and home price falls didn't hit then. It took a number of years to work through. And this is the other thing that I keep saying to people. Don't think of this as a sort of a V-shaped blip and everything's going to be fine again, right? This is going to grind on for a long, long time.
Yeah, so, you know, I've been on the record. I know I've said on your show that I think home prices are coming down, and people keep saying, well, why aren't they coming down? You know, they keep going up, and I tell people it's a delayed reaction. You know, it takes a while before, you know, I start foreclosing, and then that goes, you know, back to the banks, and then the prices fall apart. It does take a while. Plus, we're seeing this big move right now, kind of an exodus out of major cities out to the country, because people – and I don't know what your thoughts on this are, Martin, but my view is this is a short-term issue. The notion that people are not going to go back into an office ever again, I don't think that's true. But I think in the short term, that works. You know, if I'm a 30-year professional at my company or in my industry, yeah, you can send me home because you're paying me well enough that I'm going to get up every morning and do my job. But if you're a new hire, how do I mentor you? If you're, you know, there's that synergy that happens in an office. I think we come back to it. But at the moment, housing is strong. But what's going to happen when all those people that want to move out of cities have moved out and left all those empty rentals?
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, we keep pulling demand forward and thinking we're going to get, you know, more demand. And the reality is we get less demand and an eventual crash.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, we're seeing some evidence here in Australia of people thinking, well, maybe I should move further out, you know, because of the virus. But we've also got the countervailing force, which is that there are very strong forces saying, no, we have to try and get our CBDs working again. In fact, there was a report that came out that said Melbourne CBD looked as though it was going to be financially very sick for a long period of time. And I noticed that in London, they're now talking about, strategies and incentives to bring people back into the CBD. So I agree with you. I don't think the CBD is dead. The central business districts, I think we're still going to see a lot of focus there and a lot of effort to try and bring people back. And you're quite right, too. I mean, I worked inside a large companies. And the fact is, you have to have some social structure in those companies to bring people through and help them develop and all those other things. You can't do it all virtually.
Right. And I think another factor for the Australian market is it was heavily supported by Chinese buyers, too. And I don't know what the status of that is, but I'm kind of going to guess that that's drying up kind of with everywhere else. And that was a problem here in the U.S. too. They were coming and buying higher end homes in really nice cities. And all of a sudden, poof, they kind of just disappeared. So, yeah, I think the game gets played a little longer, but people that are on the sidelines, you know, with cash looking to get into the real estate market, I hate to tell them it's a waiting game. It could be another year or two, but when the opportunity comes, you want to be able to walk into that bank and have virtually no debt, cash on hand, and your credit score as high as possible, because the banks aren't going to want to lend, but they will lend a few people, and you want to be one of those.
Absolutely. Well, I've got exactly the same view. So I've been having a series of conversations on a one-on-one basis with people who are interested in property and trying to work out what to do, right? And generally, my thoughts are, no need to panic, right? You know, there is no massive takeaway from this point in terms of upside on property, right? It's going to go sideways, it's going to go down, and the window of opportunity is down the road, you know? So just relax, just take it easy, just watch what's going on. Enjoy it from the sidelines, get more prepared, and then you can pounce later. You don't need to do it now.
Yeah, waiting is so hard. And I tell people, even from an investment standpoint, is, you know, whether you want to buy stocks, it's like, now is not the right time. You have to wait or go find something else to put your money in the meantime. And sometimes, you know, just sitting on the sideline and stacking up cash is okay. You know, you and I are old enough to know this phrase, cash is king. A lot of younger people don't know what that means. It just means that you're looking around the world and saying, yeah, there's not a tremendous amount of opportunities, or what they are, I don't know if I can get in and out quick enough. So I'm just going to kick back, build up my cash pile and wait. And when the opportunities start coming, then I'll go in.
Yeah, well, you know, the Ray Dalio said the other week, you know, cash is trash, and I keep getting that thrown back at me from all sorts of quarters, you know. But I actually am of a completely different view, which is more in line with your view, which is sometimes it is the right thing to do, which is just to sit there, just wait, right? Just let things pass and then strike. Because the risk is with the markets where they are at the moment, and you know, we've discussed before, it's probably way higher than it should be. They probably will come back at some point, because this momentum that we've seen inside the financial markets is just an anomaly, isn't it?
It is, and part of the reason we're hearing the cash is trash is because everyone thinks the dollar is going to zero. Mm. And I every time I hear that, I kind of chuckle. It's like, yeah, the global reserve currency that's got $10 trillion in foreign-denominated dollar debt, not to mention a whole bunch of American workers that have all these loans on deferment and haven't been paying on, that suddenly there's no demand for dollars. No, the fear is the dollar demand is going to come back, and when it does, it's going to whipsaw the global economy. And people aren't ready for that. But yeah, if people don't want their dollars, I'm happy to accept all of them.
Exactly right. Now, look, there's a couple of things I want to touch on before we close. One of them is your critical point, and I just want to underscore it for people, that, you know, all of this talk about money printing, right, is not really getting to the truth, right? It's money swapping, isn't it?
Correct. The whole notion that quantitative easing is money printing is completely false. Now, it is a narrative that the Fed wants you to believe. And a lot of people don't understand that Fed policies are mostly psychological. If you go back and start reading some of the older minutes, there's a point in the history, in the more recent history, where they figure out that jawboning, or what's called forward guidance, is actually their most effective policy. Because if, Martin, I can convince you that inflation's coming tomorrow, so you run out and finance, say, a new TV, a new car, or something, well, that creates money. And if I convince enough people to do that, enough money is created, and then bingo, I get my inflation. So that's why we hear the Fed saying what they're saying. But in quantitative easing really isn't money printing at all. What it is it takes a reserve asset, which is a treasury or a mortgage-backed security. Now, those range in anywhere from, you know, 1 week to 30-year maturity. So let's just say somewhere between an average of 5 to 7 year maturity, and the Fed swaps it with an overnight reserve or a cash asset. Now, the where the money printing comes from is people believe that the Fed is giving the banks actually money for this, and that is not true at all. The Fed is taking those treasuries and mortgage-backed securities off the market. So they're removing them from the market, and they're giving the banks a cash reserve asset. The key part is it's a reserve asset. It is not actual cash that, you know, say, Martin, you sold me your watch and you know, I give you cash. You now actually have cash. In this case, what it looks like is a collateral account. And the whole purpose of these reserve assets is effectively property of the Fed. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. Now, the bank's name is on it, but they can't do anything with that other than use it to lend against. And the whole purpose is, if you pull enough treasuries off the market, right, if you take supply and reduce it, well, what happens to interest rates? Well, they go down. Hmm. And that's, if you go to the Fed's website, they're very clear. QE is meant to cause lower interest rates. But where does it actually spur inflation? Is if they can convince the banks to lend against those cash reserve assets. Now, there's one big problem with that is when you look at those reserve assets, you have to think of them as collateral as against a loan loss. Now, a normal treasury security, a bank could sell, raise cash if a loan goes bad, but they can't sell this reserve asset that the Fed gives them. So when a bank lends against this, not only do they have to risk their capital, but as a borrower, I have to risk my collateral. And so the banks aren't willing to do that right now. So as a result, what actually happens is, because the banks aren't receiving dollars, so to speak, for their treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, the Fed's actually pulling liquidity out of the system, even though they're claiming otherwise, but they're pulling liquidity out of the system with lower rates to tighten financial conditions to get the banks to lend. And until the banks lend, which is kind of what we talked about earlier about, you know, lending standards being so critical here, you actually get the opposite of what the Fed wants. They actually tighten conditions until either they get lending growth or the system crashes like it did in 2008.
Absolutely. And I think this is, that's probably the most critical thing that people need to understand, right? Because it's not reported right in the mainstream media, certainly here in Australia. It's not reported right on many of the other channels that I see as well. And people just have this illusion of more notes flying around the system, right? And that's not what this is about at all.
Right. Well, and let's do some validation on that, because people still struggle with that. All right. Well, if that was the case, lending standards wouldn't be tight because banks would be flush with cash and want to unload it because they'd be afraid of inflation. Interest rates would be just skyrocket. And then the only missing piece, the third leg of the stool, would be the dollar should be completely crashing. A lot of people say, well, it's toast, it's falling. It's like, well, it's at the bottom end of its five-year range. I mean, you can't really say that it's crashing and hang tight because it's headed higher. Mm-hmm. So you look at the circumstantial evidence and you can really say, no, it is not money printing at all. And you know, you have to come back to 2008, and people don't understand why we had the financial crisis. It's simply because the Fed tightened conditions, hoping they were going to ease quick enough, and they didn't. And so the Fed's bigger, better, and faster is actually worse. The more the Fed does, the faster they do it, it crashes the system. And you go back to March and look at what happened in the equity market, and you look at everything. I mean, the system almost broke then. But it pulled out of it. The next time, the Fed will come in with several trillion of QE. The next time the market goes down, the whole system will crumble apart.
And that takes us to the other thing I wanted to touch on, which is, you know, there are a lot of people talking about this is all intentional, right? There is an intentional process to crash the market in some way and to create something new out of the ashes, you know, call it conspiratorial or call it just a central bank collaboration. What's your perspective on all of that?
Well, I do believe the banks do want to crash the economy. However, the Fed, I don't think does. So you have to look at the Fed as like a golf cart, right? If you've ever been in a golf cart and has two buttons, right? Forward and reverse. So that's what the Fed can do. They can either, you know, ease or tighten. Well, logically, they're going to ease. The problem is the Fed doesn't understand that easing tightens financial conditions until it eases. That's the part they don't get. Now, the banks, on the other hand, realize they've got a lot of bad debt out there. And a lot of people struggle when I say this, that they don't have enough high-quality credit customers. And people, well, what do you mean? Look, the bank wants all these, you know, houses and loans to, you know, crumble. They want them to do that, and they want the Fed to come in and bail them out, and then they're going to sell them to rich people at low interest rates, just like they did after the financial crisis. If you look at what the rich did, they picked up homes and businesses and real estate. I mean, they picked up, it was just, no one, you and I couldn't get loans, but if you were rich enough, man, it was no problem.
Yeah.
That's what the banks want. They want to put assets in the hands of people they know can make the payments. So I look at the bank's perspective, and they're going to force the Fed's hand. And then when the Fed, you know, jams that, you know, QE again, thinking they're easing conditions, they're going to hyper tighten them. And then kaboom, we get a complete replay of the great financial crisis, but only worse.
Yeah. And I'm seeing the same here. So there is more and more calls for, you know, the government or the Reserve Bank here in Australia to rescue the banks and make sure that they don't actually have all of these bad loans and, you know, bad properties on their books. And people are even talking about, well, maybe you know, they should take them off. And, you know, so we're seeing the same calls. And it's all because, of course, the banks want to protect the banks.
Absolutely. And then, and you look at lending, you know, growth, which is what, and I don't know in Australia how often it's reported, but in the US it's reported every Friday. There's none. And in a debt-based economy, you need this expansion of debt. Well, if you see debt flatten or contract, as we're starting to see it now, it's not an if, it's a when asset prices will come crumbling down. And people, that's why we come back to this, you know, real estate prices aren't coming down. Look, this is exactly what happened. Go back to the 2008 data, and you see all of a sudden the slowdown in lending growth, and then it's turned into a contraction. Then in a debt-based monetary system, that means asset prices must come down. The problem this time, and I know you'll agree with Martin, the world has a lot of really bad debt. I mean, we literally just papered over this moldy debt from the last crisis with even more garbage debt. And the wallpaper looked really good. We're like, oh yeah, that looks great. Well, no, it's so rotten underneath that it's going to be ugly, unfortunately. Yeah. And I don't wish this on anybody. It's just a fact of, you know, we just have all this bad debt.
Yeah, and on that, you know, the root cause of all the issue is too much debt and the debt in the wrong places and doing the wrong things. Zombie companies who basically manage to prop themselves up by issuing bonds and then buying back shares, but not actually creating real value. Many households locked into so much debt that they don't know what to do, and now their unemployment is rising. I mean, wherever you look, you can see the early leading indicators of trouble ahead. But like we said, this always takes longer to work through, and it takes a lot of different elements to sort of fall before you actually see the outfall. And I keep saying this is not something that's going to be just a few months. This is going to be a number of years, and it's going to be long and painful and difficult. But in a way, you've got to find a way to get through this, because the other alternative is just to allow the debt balloon to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and take over everything.
Right. I mean, and you look at what Powell is saying, even he knows that monetary policy is its limits, because what do we hear him saying? More fiscal, more fiscal, more fiscal. Well, that's not going to work. I mean, it's real simple. If you've got a bush or a tree in your yard that's struggling and dying, it's got some brown stuff, what do? You prune off all the dead stuff to give the what little there of life a chance to grow and let all the nutrients and water get to the healthy part. Well, stay with debt-based economies. If you have good debt creating economic growth, that's great. That's what you want. But when you have bad debt and you're supporting bad debt with more bad debt, well, eventually it comes crumbling down. And unfortunately for a lot of baby boomers around the world, it's going to come at a very inopportune time.
Yeah, no, I agree. And look, the final issue just want to touch on is this, that there are people, and I tend to be on the sort of the, I think they're right sort of camp, that says, look, the whole concept of capitalism, which is that effectively you allocate cash and to things that grow, and there is a natural evolutionary cycle, and some will fail, some won't fail. The whole idea is you throw more money at the things that are successful, and that creates more wealth, and it creates a bigger, more buoyant economy. And yet now what we've got is a system whereby you can't fail. Everything is being supported. Businesses are being supported, and banks are being supported, and the economy is being supported by governments, right? And so therefore the question is, have we actually lost capitalism in all this?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, because how is it working now? If I'm a big business owner in my area and I employ, let's say, a couple thousand people, I'm going to go whine to my senator or my other congressman and say, look, you got to bail me out. And of course, they don't want me going to the employee and say, hey, look, so-and-so, they didn't help us out. Don't vote for them. So what you have is a system of effectively trying to buy jobs. But the reality is, if a company is bad, if there's rot, you need to bankrupt it. Let the assets go to the back to the bank. Let someone else or the employees come in, recapitalize a company, get a new board, or sell it off to someone who knows what they're doing, for pennies on the dollar that can make the business work and restart the system. But no, we're in this system where, when I was a kid, it was like, it was okay to fail. I mean, it was fine. If you fell off your bike and you skinned your knee, it wasn't, oh no, let's pad you up. No, it was, hey, you'll learn when you get tired of falling. And now we won't let people fail. And, I've told my, my wife's kids as they were growing up, I said the best thing that we can do for them as parents is to let them fail while they're young, because I don't want a 45-year-old kid with three kids calling me up saying I need to come home because things didn't work out. I can help you a lot more when you're 16 years old and come home crying because things didn't go the way you wanted at school. I can fix them. But we won't let people fail. We won't let businesses fail. And if we don't let them fail, they won't learn. And believe me, from the ashes, you can create a lot of great things. And we will. It's inevitable. But right now, it's just saved jobs because, politics. And I don't agree with it. But, I'm not important enough to make those decisions.
No, but the point is, and you've absolutely hit the nail on the head, the decisions are being taken for short-term political ends rather than for long-term economic outcomes, right? And unfortunately, there is a bit of groupthink among many different Western societies in particular, but perhaps more broadly too, that it's the politics that matter rather than the economics that matter. Or put it another way, the politics matter rather than people matter. And that's frankly what I get frustrated about, because it seems to me that we've lost the plot.
It is, and people do want it though. And I tell people, look, you think you want the government bails, you want all this, them to borrow money and give it to you. And what you don't realize is the greater the amount of government debt, the fewer jobs, because there's a balance between the government and the private industry. And if they're both growing, you know, in debt and expanding, you can do that. But at some point, if the government starts outweighing it, it kills jobs. And a lot of Americans and a lot of people around the world don't realize that all this aggressive borrowing to save companies is just going to end up in job loss. We're going to end at the same spot. We're just going to have more debt for, and we're going to look back in the history books, I hope, are going to say that this was really stupid, but who knows?
Well, we won't know until we look back, I guess, but certainly the leading indicators that you and I see would certainly suggest that the policy settings are actually pretty wrong at the moment. And, you know, people grasp on gold or they grasp on other things to try and, you know, solve the problem. But actually, unless we unpick the root causes that we've touched on today, it's going to be very troublesome to see what's going to happen. And I do come back to the point again that I can't see how this can actually go forward without crunching in some way, right? It's more a question of how long it's going to take, where the crunch hits, and then effectively rebuilding beyond that point. That is what I think we should be thinking about rather than trying to stop the crunch in the first place.
Yeah, and it's inevitable because everyone thinks, oh, no, the market go up, housing prices go up. Well, the problem is they don't understand how credit works. And when you have a credit contraction in a debt-based economy, it will win. It will eventually beat you. And when it does, you can't stop it. And so it's kind of interesting that, you know, I think by now, and I know you'll agree with me, Martin, that this should have probably started to fall apart sooner. The problem is the longer we stretch it out, you know, the longer we prop it up, the inevitably the worse it gets. And it's unfortunate because it used to be back in a period before at least the United States had central banks, we would have a 4-year expansion and a 6-month recession. Odds are, if you and I were in different parts of the country, we wouldn't even, if you lost your job, I would never even know because it was isolated to certain pockets and parts of the country. Now when it happens, it hurts everybody, but you know, we're bent on having these, you know, 8-10 year expansions and massive debt pileups and think that there's no way out or there's no negatives to it. Yeah, well, I'm not taking that bet.
nor I. Steve, it's great to talk with you again. Thank you very much for sharing your insights with us. If people want to find out more, where do they go?
Oh, thanks, Martin. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. They can find me on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. I do a 15 to 20 minute macro show on YouTube, and I'd certainly love to have them come check me out. I know many of your other fans have, and they've had a great time. So welcome to have them. And as always, Martin, my friend, it's been a pleasure to be on your show.
Enjoyed talking with you. Take care and hang in there. We will talk again soon, I guess, as these things develop, because, you know, the more it changes, the more it stays the same.
Yes. Well, with election coming up, I'm sure you and I may have quite a few things to talk about in a few weeks.
Take care. Keep safe. Thanks,
Steve. All
right,
Steve. You too.